Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on media power. Keeping an eye on power right after this message. Hey, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep 41% of what you create and produce. Government gets 59%. That's about $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. I thought you'd think that was just real special. Now, what if you think that your share isn't enough for you? Then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much next year? That's right, make $100,000 next year. Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year. And you're going to net 24% and the government's going to net 76%. That means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more, 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year, guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. You produce 100% more and collect 8. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 24% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we're paying so much and receiving so little. Now, in order for you to order your free general law CD package, just call direct. The number to call, 417-273-4967, or you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. Remember, my tax and status school is also available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. Remember, that number is 417-273-4967. Remember, Bill Moyer is on PBS. PBS show now airs on Friday night here in my neck of the woods. Bill Moyer is an old political analyst, worked for the Johnson administration. He's a left-wing radical liberal. Every once in a while, though, Bill Moyers comes up with something that's pretty good. Now is a pretty good program. It's a little biased to the left, but listen to this. Bill Moyers, keeping an eye on power, says, freedom and freedom of the press were birth twins of the revolution. They grew up together, and neither has fared well without the other. And at times, journalism has risen to great occasions and even made other freedoms possible. From editors who went defiantly to prison after being charged under the Sedition Act for circulating opinions that questioned the motives of Congress or criminating, whatever that meant, the president, to the willingness of Arthur Sulzberger and Katherine Graham to risk criminal prosecution under espionage laws if they printed the Pentagon Papers. Or from Lincoln, Stephens, and Ida Tarbell and Upton Sinclair taking on the shame of the cities and the crimes of the trusts and the treason of the Senate to Walter Cronkite devoting an entire broadcast to Watergate. From Seymour Hersh reporting on torture to 60 Minutes to broadcasting the horror of Abu Ghraib, the greatest moments in journalism have come not when journalists made common cause with power, but when they stood fearlessly and independent of it. How is it an old press secretary can speak in awe of a press that once held his own feet to the fire? Well, there are two reasons. I grew up in the Deep South. For a long time, we were in denial about the truth of slavery. The truth tellers among us were driven from the pulpit, driven from the newsroom, driven from the classroom. It took a terrible swift sword, a civil war, to drive home the truth about slavery, and then it took another 100 years of suffocating conformity before the victory of Appomattox was fully realized. Then I did indeed serve in the Johnson administration when we circled the wagons and for too long failed to face the facts that we were facing on the ground in Vietnam. And although it was hard to acknowledge at the time, it was the David Halberstams and the Morley Safers and the Peter Arnetts who were right about reality. I.F. Stone also. I see in my mind's eye as I speak a smiling I.F. Stone, having just published another of his little 4-page weekly exposing the contradictions in the government's own documents, pausing long enough amidst the thunder of battle to declare, "I have so much fun, I ought to be arrested." Quite a story we can tell, and quite a tradition we serve. So why, when we pause to celebrate it, as we are here tonight, why, despite plenty of lip service on every ritual occasion to freedom of the press, why are we so uneasy, so uncertain, so anxious for our craft here in the 21st century? Well, partly it's because of the secrecy. The secrecy today is so thick as to be all but impenetrable. In earlier times, there were padlocks for the presses and jail cells for outspoken editors and writers as our governing bodies tried to squelch journalistic freedom with blunt instruments of the law. Now it's the classifier's top secret stamp used indiscriminately is as potent a silencer as a writ of arrest. It is so bad now, the president and CEO of the Associated Press, Tom Curley, last week, called publicly for a media advocacy center to lobby in Washington, D.C. for an open government. Now, you don't need to have your notebook snatched by a policeman, he said, to know that keeping an eye on government has lately gotten a whole lot harder. With very little public debate, Congress gives government agencies the right to search your home, search your office, search your telephone logs, emails, medical records, restaurant receipts, even your banking and credit card information without your consent or knowledge. The president signs an executive order postponing thousands of declassified documents that are 25 years old or more. Then he signs another executive order sending hundreds of millions of tax dollars to religious organizations with no obligation to show us where the money's going or how it's going to be used. And now, for the first time in our history, the vice president is given the power to decide what is classified and what is not. Behind closed doors, key environmental protections are shredded, and in the middle of the night, without so much as a single fingerprint left in the margin, an anonymous hand inserts into an omnibus bill a loophole providing billions of dollars in subsidies to powerful clients in powerful industries. Secrecy poisons democracy, and there's only one antidote. When a student asked the journalist Richard Reeves to define real news, Reeves answered, "It's the news that we all need to keep our freedom." It's not just government that's squeezing out this news. Some of the media giants are doing it themselves. As the media giants consolidate their ownership, they're shrinking their news holes, isolating public affairs far from prime time. And a study by Mark Cooper of the Consumer Federation of America reports that nearly two-thirds of today's newspaper markets are now monopolies. Take a look at a recent book called Leaving Readers Behind. It's called The Age of Corporate Newspapering, published as part of the project on the state of the American newspaper under the auspices of the Pew Charitable Trust and the leadership of Gene Roberts, the former managing editor of the New York Times. The report describes a furious, unprecedented blitz of buying, selling, and consolidating of newspapers from the mightiest daily to the humblest weeklies. In 1950, there were 50 major newspaper corporations in America. Today, there are six. A world where small hometown dailies are being bought and sold like hog futures, where chains now devour other whole chains, where they are effectively ceding whole regions of the country to one another, further minimizing competition, where money is now pouring into the business from interests with little knowledge and even less concern about the special obligations that newspapers have in our republic. The authors point to the Daily in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, with a circulation of 23,500, a paper that prided itself on being a hometown hands, or in hometown hands, since the Andrew Johnson administration after the Civil War in the 1860s. But in 1998, it was sold not once, but twice within the space of 2 months. 2 years later, it was sold again, four owners in less than 3 years. In New Jersey, the Gannett chain bought the Asbury Park Press, sent in a publisher who slashed 50 people from the staff, and cut the space for news, and then was rewarded by being named Gannett's Manager of the Year. Well, you better get used to it. And all of these authors conclude that it won't be long before America is reduced to half a dozen major print organizations, according to the Nonpartisan Project for Excellence in Journalism. Newspapers have 2,200 fewer employees than they had in 1990. And the number of full-time radio news employees has dropped by 44% between 1994 and 2000. And the number of broadcast network correspondents has dropped by one-third, since the 1980s. And the number of TV network forum bureaus has been cut by half. Now, except for 60 Minutes on CBS, the network primetime news magazines in no way could be said to cover major news of the day. Furthermore, the report finds that 68% of the news on cable news channels was repetitious accounts of previously reported stories without any new information. Now, we know what happens when robust journalism bites the dust. The Pew report tells of examples like Cumberland, Maryland, where the police reporter had so many duties piled upon him that he no longer had time to go to the police station for the daily reports. But newspaper management had a cost-saving solution, and that was to put a fax machine in the police station and let the police send over the news that they thought the paper should have. The report by Pew includes a 1999 survey that showed a massive retreat in the coverage of key departments and agencies in Washington, including the Supreme Court and State Department. At the Social Security Administration, whose activities literally affect every American today, only the New York Times was maintaining a full-time reporter. At the Interior Department, which controls 500 to 600 million acres of public land and looks after everything from the National Park Service to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, there are no full-time reporters reporting on the Department of Interior. That's right here in Washington. Now, not across the country, there is simultaneously a near blackout of local politics by broadcasters. The public interest group Alliance for Better Campaigns studied 45 stations in six cities in 1 week in October, and they found that out of 7,560 hours of programming that they analyzed, only 13 hours were devoted to local public affairs, less than one-half of 1% of local programming nationwide. Meanwhile, as the secrecy grows and media conglomerates put more and more power in fewer and fewer hands, we have witnessed the rise of a new phenomenon, a quasi-official partisan press, ideologically linked to an authoritarian administration that is in turn the ally and the agent of powerful financial and economic interests that consider transparencies a threat to their hegemony over public opinion. All right, you're listening to The Law. We're on the editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Hey, did you know that the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values? And that's because these two programs are the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's right. These programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. This income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. The income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. And the income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And this income tax requires that we sign contracts with foreign and alien gods called government in violation of Exodus 23, verse 32 and 33. And Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. And Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. And then we're taught to call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it just what it is, covetousness and theft, in violation of Exodus 20, verses 15 and 17. Now, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention followed that better way, and I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice a better way of life than income tax and Social Security. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And Tax and Status is available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and then send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's free of charge, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a Bill Moyer speech to the Press Association. I think Moyer hit the nail right on the head. There's a secrecy, Homeland Security, the Patriot Act. There is a whole host and plethora of things wrong with government today that have become and are becoming progressively worse. As we look back 50 years, things weren't as bad as they are today. And over that 50 years, we see a degeneration in our national way of life, our national political scene. He goes on to say that this convergence dominates the marketplace of political ideas in a phenomenon unique to our history. Stretching from the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal to Rupert Murdoch's empire, to the nattering nabobs of Know Nothing Radio, to a legion of think tanks bought and paid for by corporations circling the honeypots of government, there is a vast echo chamber which resounds with a conformity of opinion, serving a partisan worldview which cannot be proven wrong because it admits no evidence to the contrary. When you challenge them with evidence to the contrary, when you try to hold their propaganda to scrutiny, you're likely to wind up in the modern equivalent of a medieval Iron Maiden between the covers, that is, of an Ann Coulter tirade, or wake up in an underground cell at Fox News, force-fed leftovers from a Roger Ailes snack, and required for 24 hours a day to stare at photographs of Rupert Murdoch on the walls of the cell while listening to a piped-in Bill O'Reilly singing the Hallelujah Chorus in praise of himself. Now, what's happening here tonight is very important. Your recognition of journalism is more than ritual, more than ceremony, or more than even celebration. You're confirming what journalism can do, No, I don't want to claim too much for this craft, but I don't want to claim too little either. I believe journalism and democracy are deeply linked in whatever chances we Americans have to redress our grievances, retake our politics, and reclaim our commitment to equality and justice. And one last thing. The character in Tom Stoppard's play Night and Day summed it up very well when he said, "People do terrible things to each other, but it's worse in places where everything is kept in the dark." So says Bill Moyer. I think old Bill hit the nail on the head. I came up with a journalistic review here in Journalistic Fraud, reviewing the New York Times. New York Times isn't the only paper in the country. That's the problem. All of the newspapers, all of the news media, what we call the mainstream press, is the problem. Now, in another Spiker report, I came across The Calamity Howler by Albert Krebs, The Calamity Howler, number 6. It's a story on Ronald Reagan. I didn't agree with the entirety of the story on Ronald Reagan. I thought it was extreme, but there were some facts in here that I thought I would share to you. Facts that not just cover the Ronald Reagan years, but cover the period from about 1950 to the present. Not just a tirade against Republicans or a tirade against Democrats, but rather a factual analysis of what's happened to America over the past 50 years. So gather around, boys and girls, and let me tell you what's been going on here in America over the past 50 years. Reagan was still calling the shots early in the decade after leaving office. And where has all of this left us? After the Ronald Reagan years, the Bush and the Clinton years, and now the Bush Jr. years, to paraphrase Ronald Reagan when he was running for office, he said, "Are you better off than you were 25 years ago?" And I think that's a fair question. Because if I were to answer the question, I would say yes, George Gordon is better off today in 2004 than I was in 1980. 1979. But for the majority of Americans, you can't say that. Now listen to these facts. The media doesn't even ask this question, but if it did, here are just a few of the things that it would discover, much of it easily retrievable from its own clip files. Now, number one, the traditional pension, an American employee benefit that was widely available until the early 1980s, has been vanishing from the American workplace ever since, and more than two-thirds of older households today, those headed by people 47 to 64, had someone earning a pension in 1983, but by 2001, fewer than half did. That's from the New York Times. And in the 1980s, about two-thirds of corporations included health care benefits with their pensions. Today, only about one-third do. In April of 2004, the nation's trade gap hit a record $48 billion. In 1 month, $48 billion. Precisely the sort of thing that extreme capitalism, free trade, and globalization was supposed to prevent. What this globalization has caused and created is exactly what they told us was bad for us and that it was going to prevent. And the top 1%'s share of household wealth had dropped from 1929 to 1981, from 44% to 27%. Now, the top 1% of the household wealth had dropped from the period 1929 to 81 from 44 to 27%. The Congressional Budget Office says the income gap in the United States is now the widest in 75 years. And while the richest 1% of the U.S. population saw its financial wealth grow 109% from 83 to 2001, the bottom 40% watched its wealth fall 46%. So from about 1975 to the present, about one half of Americans, 40%, that's close to a half, have seen their wealth, their incomes, their real purchasing power drop by nearly half, 46%. I can't see that that's progress. There's something going on here, boys and girls, over the last 50 years, and I'm not here to point fingers at Republicans or Democrats. I just want you to think about the statistics and the numbers. From 1900 to 1950, we were growing. From 1950 to 2000, we've been shrinking. Has it occurred to us that perhaps the communism that we're practicing in America is bringing upon us poverty? And while we're concerned about Iraq, has it ever come to our minds that maybe we need to make some real political change here in America, maybe some real political change at our family level? Now, the Congressional Budget Office says that the income gap in the United States is wider now than it has been in 75 years. Now, I'm only 65 years old. You'd have to go back to 1929 to find the income gap as wide as it is today. Edward N. Wolfe, he's an economist at New York University, found that the average net worth of an older household grew 44%, adjusted for inflation from 1983 to 2001. It grew to $673,000, but much of that growth was in the accounts of the richest households, which pushed the averages up. So when Mr. Wolf looked at the net worth of the median older household, the one at the midpoint of the economic ladder, which is a better indicator of what is typical, the picture changed. That figure declined by 2.2% or $4,000 during the period to $199,900. Now, for a generation to emerge from two bullish decades with less wealth than its parents had is very remarkable. And Mr. Wolf had this observation. He said, based on economic growth and market returns over those 18 years, he said, their wealth should be up by 30 to 40%, but it isn't. Now, translated into modern English, if you take a look at this 20-year period from 1980, when Ronald Reagan took over, about 81, through the Bush years here of 2004, we have the two most bullish decades in the history of America. I mean, our economy has been growing. And we went through the Clinton years, and we went through this huge stock market bubble. During the Reagan years was growth, growth, growth. Even through the Bush years, there was a minor recession in 91, 92, and Clinton got the credit for ending that recession, and we went into this bullish bull market period. Remember that? 20 year. Now, you'd think we'd be better off, wouldn't you? Now, here's the New York Times reporting the facts. Delivered by Edward N. Wolf, he's an economist at New York University. I'm going to repeat this again. He found that the average net worth of an older household grew by 44%, adjusted for inflation from 83 to 2001. It grew to $673,000. So he says, let's just take a George Gordon. I'm one of those. Everything for me grew. Now, one of the reasons is I'm on a gold standard, and I practice the Mosaic Law, and I practice property and property rights. I don't practice communism. I'm not a social democrat, and I'm kind of a wild March hare. And they took a look at people like me. You know, I'm 65 now, so just picture yourself right along with me. And I'm in that top half of the John Kerrys and the George Bushes, the people who were in the minority of wealth gainers over that period. I'm in that minority. And he says, our wealth went up to $673,000, but much of that growth was in the accounts of the richest households, which actually pushed the averages up. All right, so the Bushes and the Buffetts and all these rich people in the country helped to push my average up. And I said a little earlier, I'm better off, as Ronald Reagan asked back when he was running for election back in 1980, if you remember. He said, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, 8 years ago, or 25 years ago? My answer to that, remember, was yes. Now listen to this. When Mr. Wolf looked up the net worth of the median older household, the one at the midpoint of the economic ladder, which is a better indicator of what is typical, the picture changed. The figure actually declined by 2.2%. Now, why should we go through the two most bullish decades of in the history of America? Isn't that what we were told? I mean, we're really making money. And our net worth declined by 2.2% or $4,000 during the period. Now, for a generation to emerge from two bullish decades with less wealth than its parents had is remarkable, he said. And based on economic growth, the market returns over those 18 years, he said, were their wealth should be up 30 to 40%. But it wasn't. Here's another kicker. From 1973 to the present, 2004, your wages have gone up 1% in 30 years. In real purchasing power, your wages have gone up by 1%. You keep getting raises, but it doesn't buy anything more. Your standard of living is essentially where it was in 1973. To compensate for that, we now have 50% of our wives, our women, working in the workforce. So now we have two incomes coming in, and we're getting further behind because our debt per capita is growing. It's not shrinking. It's growing. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Hey, when you're making $50,000 a year, you pay about $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then you pay a 17% income tax on that $50,000. That's another $8,500. Now, you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. Now, that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that you're being told. Isn't that just special? Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Call and ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and Status is available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Meanwhile, for households of all ages between 1983 and 1998, the average household net worth of the poorest 40% of the population in our country declined by 76%. From 83 to 98, if you're in the bottom of the economic scale in America, your income, your net household worth, has declined by 3/4, which just tells us that the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. Now, the biggest indicator of a healthy society, average life expectancy dropped. People in the United States now don't live even as long as the people in Costa Rica. And meanwhile, the U.S. infant mortality rate has risen, so much so that Cuba has a better success rate of bringing healthy children into the world. Did you get that? You know, we've been bragging for years about the health of the American people. Now, this is the best place in the world to get sick because we have the best medical technology in the world. But we're not the healthiest nation in the world, by far. In 1983, 50 corporations controlled most of the news media in America. And by 2002, six corporations held most of the news media. They own most of the newspapers, etc. Six corporations. Between 1981 and 1997, children from age 3 to 12 spent 25% less time playing, an hour less a week eating meals, 1/2 hour less a week sitting and talking with somebody at home. Home life is deteriorating. The number of Americans without health insurance climbed 33% during the 1990s, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Now, I don't have health insurance, and I don't want health insurance, and I don't want it forced upon me. But Americans believe that health insurance is a part and parcel of the American dream, that it's like having a home in the suburbs. It's like having an automobile or two and a vacation. And yet, during the Democratic administration of the 1990s, you know, the Clinton years, you find that the number of people without health insurance has climbed by 33%. It's not getting any better under Bush. I'm not sitting here advocating health insurance. I'm just here telling you that here is a part of your standard of living. It's going down. America's standard of living is deteriorating and has been since the 1970s. I'm just reporting to you that you're not living as well today as your parents did. My dad could support his family in the 1950s by himself and buy a new car every other year. My wife reports to me that her dad supported their family in the 1950s. They had six children. My dad only had two, but there was six in her family, and he bought a car every other year working by himself. Today, Americans with two incomes coming in can't make ends meet. It's not getting better, boys and girls. It's getting poorer and poorer. Farmers in 1999 were getting 36% less for their products in real dollar terms than they did in 1984. So you farmers are getting 36% or a third less today than you were in 1984. In 1980, there were less than 500,000 people in prison, about less than a half a million in prison in 1980. By the year 2000, there were 2 million in prison. In 1980, 8% of the prisoners were there for drug offenses. By 1998, 28% were. Now, we've got this gigantic war on drugs spending billions of dollars to control drugs in America. We got more drug addicts than ever. Four times as many people in prison as we had in 1980. And crime is just as pervasive today as it was in 1980. So the crime scene isn't getting better, it's getting worse. The drug scene isn't getting better, it's getting worse. And under the Bush administration, when they went into Afghanistan, remember, in the year 2001, the Taliban, you know, that evil, wicked government, the terrorist outfit over there that we had to overthrow, they had reduced the acreage of poppy production in Afghanistan, which Afghanistan was the world's number one supplier of heroin, has been for many years. They reduced it from 150,000 acres to 4,000 acres under their regime. Since the Americans took over in December of 2001, poppy production has grown from 4,000 acres to 200,000 acres, 25% more than it was at the peak when the Taliban took office. In other words, we have restored the heroin production in Afghanistan in the 3 years since we've been there under the Bush administration. Now, you can sit there and say, well, that's not our fault. We didn't intend to do that. I don't know. I'm just reporting the facts. That's the outcome. I would say if you want to control drugs, you ought to hire the Taliban. They seem to have known something about controlling drugs. I don't know if they just lined them up and shot them all or what they had in mind there, but whatever it was better than what we're done. 90% of young white male workers are now doing worse than they would have 20 years ago. Adjusted for inflation, the income of a recent male high school graduate declined 28% between 1973 and 1997. So if you just graduated from high school and you're going out into the workplace, you can expect to make 28% less than you would have graduating from high school in 1973. I'll give you a little illustration. I graduated back in 1957. By 1958, I had an airplane. I was making $4,000 a year with room and board. And I vacationed every year in Mexico and flew my own airplane to Guadalajara, Mexico City, Monterrey, Mazatlan, Hermosillo, and all points in between. And I was a kid graduated from high school. And you know what I was doing for a living? Milking cows on a dairy for $350 a month in board and room. $350 a month in board and room. And I had an airplane, a Stinson station wagon. Now, how many of you kids graduating from high school in your first year out of high school have your own airplane and vacation 30 days a year in Mazatlan? So 90% of the young white male workers are now doing worse today than they did 25 years ago. Wages for the bottom 10% of all wage earners fell 9.3% between 1979 and 99. So for the bottom 10% of American workers, those at the bottom of the ladder, you lost 10% of your wages. Not as bad as the farmers. They've lost 36% over the last 20 years, but you lost 10. Now, the median student loan debt in 1977 was $2,000. Today it's $15,000. So you students now have a $15,000 debt. The ratio of executive pay to that of a factory worker in 1980 was 42 to 1. So the boss at your company made 42 times more than you did. The ratio of executive pay to that of a factory worker today is 419 to 1. Now, if your pay compared to that of your boss had been keeping pace over the last 20 years, today you'd be making $110,000 a year. So if you're not making $110,000, you're not keeping pace with the boss. Now, I'm not opposed to the boss making more and more money. I mean, after all, that's the American dream, isn't it? But don't you think that that's a little off balance, especially when we're exporting our jobs to China? Don't you think? You're listening to The Law and the Editorial Review. Stand by. Let me give you a message. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of the early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%, and by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to pay their taxes. Well, this year, the average American family had to work through May 12th in order to earn enough money to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare that to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make you? What does that make me? You know, the income tax and Social Security violates three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. And the income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask this question. Do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Take advantage of it. It's free. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, why don't you go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967 to order yours. We're talking about the press. Bill Moyers is a left-wing radical journalist, but he comes up with some good points every now and again. I like to watch Now, his program on PBS. Keeps me abreast of what the leftists are doing, if nothing else. Every once in a while, he comes up with, gee, what's happening in America? What's happening? Well, the leftists, back in the Roosevelt years, adopted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. They've incorporated those into our public education system. We Americans now practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's what the problem is. I'm not sure Bill Moyers has figured that out yet. We call this a social democracy now. Democracies have never worked at any time in history. Our founding fathers avoided democracy like we try to avoid AIDS, herpes, and VD. And now after 50 years, well, 75 years, going back to the Roosevelt years, we find that our experiment in communism has produced some bitter fruit. And I'm giving you the report from Bill Moyers. I'm giving you the report from CBS and Time Magazine and from the Pew Trust. These are the numbers. Read them and weep, as they say down at the Blue Room. Remember in 1977, the disclosed wealth of the top 10 senators was $133 million. In 2001, it was up to $1.83 billion. Now that's $1,830 million. From $133 million to $1,830 million. In 1982, the U.S. foreign debt was less than 5% of gross domestic product. By 2002, it was 25%. Think of that. In 1982, when Reagan took over, we had a U.S. foreign debt. 5% of what we produced every year. Today, we owe 25% of what we produce every year. I've often said, you know, listen, if this is good, if these numbers, boys and girls, are good, let's double all of these numbers. Won't that be twice as gooder? Huh? If you farmers over there are getting 36% less now than you were in 1980, well, my goodness, wouldn't about 70% less be even better for you? I mean, you don't want to be pigs, do you? If the bottom 10% of income earners in the United States have lost 10% of their wages, 10% of their purchasing power over the last 20 years, wouldn't losing 20 or 25% be even better? There isn't a number on this list that's good for America. And all I hear from John Kerry and George Bush is we want more of the same. We want more free trade. Hasn't free trade exported enough jobs? Haven't we outsourced enough? I mean, is 3 million jobs exported from America to India, so remote to us that it's non-existent or it's not important? I was watching Wall Street Week the other night on PBS, and the guy said, well, gee, it's only 1% of the workforce, 1% that's been exported so far. Well, then why don't we jump it up to 2%, maybe 4%, 8%, 16%? I can't think of anything good that's come from free trade that's good for you and me. I don't deny it's good for Walmart and General Motors and IBM and Microsoft, but, you know, don't those boys have enough money? I thought we were talking about the farmers out here whose income has dropped by 36%, or the people who are in the bottom 10% of wage earners whose income fell by 9.3% over the last, you know, 30 years or 25 years. Listen to this. Between 73 and 2001, the incomes of the poorest 20% went up 14%. So your income has gone up 14%. Now, inflation's gone up two or three times what that is, but at least your income went up 14%. If you're in the middle class, it went up 19%. Inflation goes at 3% a year. So for 30 years, at 3% a year, your inflation's up 90%. Your income went up 19%. The richest 5% in the country went up 87%. Now remember that the top wage earners or the top income earners in America, that top 5%, earn $100,000 a year or more. If you're in the top percent of income earners, you've kept up with inflation or stayed ahead of it. You're better off today than you were 25 years ago. If you're making less than $100,000 a year today, then you're worse off than you were 25 years ago. So all you got to do is figure out, are you making 100 grand a year or more, and you're better off today, or you're making less than 100,000 and you're worse off? And of course, the less money you make, the worse off you are. Because you see, when you're making $100,000 a year and the price of gasoline goes from $1.50 to $2, compare that to the guy that's making $20,000 a year and the price of gas goes from $1.50 to $2. Who gets hurt the worst? You know, I sit here and I say, so the price of gas went up 4 bits. Who cares? But to a guy that's out here working for $6, $7, $8, $10 an hour, 50 cents an hour, or 50 cents a gallon, is a hell of a hit to that guy. Now, of course, if you take a look at the overall price of gas over the last 50 years, gasoline in America, $2 a gallon, is a hell of a buy. It's $5.70 in Great Britain. $5.70 a gallon in Great Britain. When you go to fill up your SUV over there, it costs you $127. Over here, it costs you about $45. So it costs you three times as much to fill up over there in Great Britain as it does here. So I'm not complaining about the price of gas, but then I'm not in the bottom of the income earners. And what I'd like to suggest to you is that you take a look at what's happened in America over the past 50 years and then ask yourself some hard questions about, if the Federal Reserve idea back in 1913 and paper money and income tax was such a good idea, why is it that our living standards are less today than they were 50 or 75 years ago? If communism was such a good idea, if big government and bigger government and bigger deficits were such a good idea, why is it that our living standards are going down, down, down instead of up, up, up? I don't think that the Republicans and Democrats with the Federal Reserve and the fascist corporate takeover of our nation and our political institutions has been as good an idea as we once thought that it probably would be. I'm not looking forward to anybody changing it in the near future, but I thought I'd bring it to your attention. The real value of the minimum wage peaked in 1969. That's right. The highest, the poorest people in our society ever earned was in 1969. It had $7 an hour worth of purchasing power. Today, you're down to $5 an hour in purchasing power. You get paid $5.15, but your purchasing power was higher in 1969 when the minimum wage was about a buck or a buck and a half an hour. I think it was a dollar and a half an hour, which equaled in purchasing power today $7, or about $2 higher than it is right now. Or put another way, you'd have to have a minimum wage of $7 an hour to equal what you had in 1969. 86% of stock market gains between 89 and 97 flowed to the top 10% of households. 42% went to the most well-to-do 1%. So if you were buying stocks and you were outside the scope of the 1% in the top financial brackets, you didn't do very well. In 1998, the top earning 1% had as much income as the 100 million Americans with the lowest earnings. You get that? In 1998, the top earning 1% of the nation had as much income as 100 million Americans at the lowest end. And the two richest men in America, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, owned more assets than the bottom 45% of the country. You take, for in round numbers, just, you know, round it off, in round numbers, if you took the bottom 50% of Americans, all of you poor people out here in America, 100 million of you combined, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett own more than you do. Two men in America. Well, all right, boys and girls, if you think that's good, then why don't we give Bill Gates and Warren Buffett 3/4 of all the wealth? Why shouldn't those two men own 90% of the wealth? Don't you think we'd all be better off if more people owned more real property? The biggest landowner in America is Ted Turner. I don't know what one man needs 4 million acres for, but has it ever occurred to us that maybe 1 million people owning 4 acres might do more for America than one man owning 4 million? Just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. So that's the state of the economy, and that's the state of the news media and the power in America, according to Bill Moyers. All right, you've been listening to The Law. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and we're heard worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the Gordon Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website. That's georgegordon.org. Hey, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.